You can now buy a Google Home Assistant with a screen. Adorable home robot Curie gets canned. What legal expectation of privacy do we have in public spaces in this digital age? And an existential discussion of robot art. All that and more on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 42, recorded Thursday, July 26th, 2018.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Slide Belts, high-quality, comfortable ratchet belts that are easy to adjust. If you want a better belt, go to slidebelts.com/twit and use the code TWIT for 20% off. Welcome to the show. This is Tech News Weekly, where every week we get to talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. How's it going, Megan?
It's going good so far. I haven't made or broken any tech news this week, so we had to have guests.
No, that's not true. You do a show on IoT for know-how, and I know that a lot of IoT devices break from time to time.
I did, yes, that is true. Well, the episode of know-how that aired today, we accidentally recorded on Prime Day when Amazon was pretty much offline, so I got a lot of, I don't know what you're talking about, Megan, instead of the Echo answering me. Like,
you didn't break
does.
It, in other words, it's Amazon's fault.
No. It's true.
Yeah, it's true.
So the much anticipated Google Home Smart Assistant with a screen is available to order starting today. And Mike Prospero from Tom's Guide is here with his review, specifically how it compares to the Amazon Echo. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you. Welcome to me. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you.
It's great to have you. So tell us about the device and specifically how it compares to the Echo Show, which you've also tried to use.
I mean, well, for starters, the Lenovo Smart Display just looks a lot better than the Echo Show. It's got a more stylish design. You can't really tell from the front, but if you turn it around, it has the 10-inch model, at least, has this bamboo back to it, and it's just much more interesting to look at. More than that, though, I mean, its screen is brighter, more colorful, and larger, too.
And there's a slider on the side to block the camera?
That's right. On the right-hand side of the smart display, it's a little button that slides up and physically blocks the camera, which is something that the Echo Show doesn't have. Mm-hmm. So it's, an extra little bit of privacy.
Yeah.
We were talking a little bit about the show. Stay on that shot for a second, if you don't mind, Victor. We were talking a little bit about the back of the device. Because I think on some of these devices, we're used to them having pretty traditional standard designs through and through. I imagine this is the side of the device that's going to be bumped up against a wall. So the fact that it's lined in bamboo and very uniquely shaped will probably be missed for some people. But why do you think that they went with this unique design, especially when many people aren't even going to see it?
Well, I think even if you're not going to look at the back of it, it is taking a chance, and I like that the fact that they're doing it. But it does serve some practical purposes. Where the tablet sort of bumps out there is where the speakers are, so you get a little more resonance from them when you're playing music and listening to tunes and things like that. But also, you can flip the smart display up into a vertical mode, into portrait mode, when you're making video calls. So it also serves as a stand for that as well.
Okay. I use the Echo Show regularly. It's a important part of my kitchen. And you pointed out something that this device does that the Echo Show doesn't do. And as so many times happens, I didn't even realize it didn't do that, but now I need it to do that. And that the screen works like an app with your IoT, your smart home stuff, so that, it doesn't just work with your lights, but you turning them off and on with your voice, but you can adjust the setting, like dimming the lights on the screen.
Yeah, that's right. When you say, turn on the lights, not only does it turn on the lights, but you get a little slider. It's almost like a little round dial, if you will, that lets you dim the lights to whatever brightness you want. And the same thing with thermostats too. You can, after you say, you know, turn the thermostat to a certain temperature, you can also fine tune it using your finger on the display. And it's something that, you know, is not included on the Echo Show. And frankly, it's a little surprising that that sort of feature isn't on the Echo Show yet, given that it's been out for a year now.
How does this do? Because I imagine a device like this, like if I was to have one, and I hope someday to have one, to replace the Google Home in our kitchen, if we had one, it would probably end up in our kitchen. I know that, you know, some people would probably put it in their bedroom, maybe as a nightstand, you know, sort of alarm clock replacement, let's say. I could see it in a kitchen. I'm sure a lot of people would. How does it do as a kitchen companion device as far as, like, you know, the recipe experience? It's one thing to, like, bark out orders on a recipe. It's another thing to have a screen to kind of guide you through step by step as you go along.
It does great. Much better than the Echo Show, in fact. When you ask for a recipe, you know, it'll first start by giving you all of the ingredients for it, and then it'll walk you through the steps, you know, one at a time. But where the smart display differentiates itself from the Echo Show is that after each step or after each ingredient, it'll pause and say, like, okay, let me know when you're ready to go to the next one. And you can advance or, you know, go back a step, not just by using your voice, but there's buttons on the screen, too, that let you move back and forward, and even skip ahead to, say, the directions. So it's really handy, you know, especially if you get lost in a step or forget something.
Yeah, it's nice.
So we use our Echo Show in the kitchen also for listening to music, and audiophiles will be upset at me for saying this, but we also have a HomePod that we often don't use, even though the sound is technically better. How's the sound on this device?
It's good. I would say it's on a par with the Echo Show. They both have two speakers in it, and the bass is really good as well, and not at the expense of vocals. Now, it's definitely not as good as the HomePod or, say, the Sonos One, but, you know, if you're using it for casual listening and things like that, this should more than suffice.
Yeah, as long as it's as good, again, if it's in my kitchen, it's replacing the standard Google Home, not the Google Home Max, like the really big, nice-sounding one. As long as it's good enough to be on par with that, then I'll be happy. What about having YouTube embedded here? I know that that's something that you can't get. You used to be able to get it on the Echo Show, I think, and then Google, you know, and Amazon got into their little hitting match, and now it's not there anymore. Personally, as a parent, I would love an option to disable YouTube. I might be in the minority, but that's a screen that's always on that my kids could always go to, and I guarantee you they figured it out on day one to go watch videos when it's not screen time. Is there any option to do that, and how is the integration?
You know, that's one thing I still have to check out to see what sort of parental controls. That's one thing where traditionally Amazon has been better at in terms of free time and things like that, limiting the amount of things that your kids can look at. But, you know, that is one thing that Google definitely should take a look at even further if they really want to make this a truly family device.
Yeah, totally. Be nice to have those controls.
Mm-hmm. And you can watch Vimeo on the Echo Show, but I'm still a little upset about them taking away because that was part of the selling point of the Echo Show. I mean, all the commercials had people watching YouTube videos in it, and it's not, Vimeo is not the same, and I've never found myself watching any Amazon Prime TV on the little screen. Like, that's not something that I don't know if people do regularly, but
do you make video calls on yours?
I do not make video calls. What I do is I have a Nest Cam and I have a Cloud Cam from Amazon, and even though Nest, you know, comes from Google, I can watch both of those on the Echo Show, but not so on this new device, right?
That's right. If you have if you have devices that Amazon owns, then they're not necessarily going to play well with the Google Lenovo display, smart display, and vice versa. So there's ways that, you know, both of them have trouble here and there integrating with each other's products, which, you know, it really is a real big disservice to the consumer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big time bummer. Ring is one of those devices that does not work. Just full disclosure, Ring is a sponsor on the network. I am a Ring user. Like, is there any indication that this is like intentional Amazon lock-in? Like Amazon just wants to make sure that its devices play well with its other devices and those outside of that don't? Or is this just a case of like, eh, we just haven't gotten around to it yet?
You know, that's a good question. There's a limited integration. Like, for example, yeah. you can ask of Google Assistant, hey, is my camera on and things like that. But the real key differentiator is, and the real thing that where these devices are great is that being able to actually view a feed from the cameras on, say, the smart display or the Echo Show. And right now there's greater integration with devices with the Echo Show than there are with the Lenovo smart display.
Yeah.
And does that come from Google or from Amazon? Or is it just like Jason said, they just haven't figured it out yet? They just haven't worked out the kinks yet?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. It may be a thing from Amazon, maybe from Google. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us. Mike's full review is at tomsguide.com. And where's the best place to follow your work besides Tom's Guide?
You can find me on Twitter at Mike Prospero.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate you. Having you on today.
Take care.
Oh.
We'll talk to you soon. Hopefully next time I will already have one of these.
Well, they're selling them at Costco for $50 off right now.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. I didn't realize that was a deal. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll get it.
Oh, we didn't even ask him how much it costs.
Well, isn't it something like $250 for the 10-inch? And then I think the smaller version, the 8-inch version, is like $50 cheaper, $60, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. So right around those price points. Can't remember exactly. The bright shining light of home robots burns just a little bit darker this week with the news that Mayfield Robotics is putting its development of the Curie robot on hold. And Mike Murphy from Quartz is seriously bummed out about that. Welcome, Mike.
Hey.
You sound seriously bummed out. Are you okay?
I am really sad, to be honest. I wrote a very sad elegy for this robot yesterday. It was legitimately a cool, impressive thing, and I'm sad it's we're not going to get to experience it.
Yeah, well, not yet anyways. You also wrote back in 2017 that the Curie was the first robot your readers might actually want in their home. What exactly did you see in Curie at that point that really set it apart from other home robot options at the time?
So there are a couple things. I mean, firstly, it's adorable to look at. It's like a tiny little penguin R2-D2 guy. I love it. Kind of looks like a little waiter, tiny little waiter bopping around your home. And Mayfield tried really hard to create something that actually did have like its own character and its own like sense of agency. And they hired, I wrote a whole feature on them and a few other companies that are like trying to make robots and AI chatbots less scary. They hired all these Pixar animators and, you know, character developers to create something that actually felt adorable, like something you'd actually want in your home, kind of bopping around. I'd never really seen that before. I mean, I guess the closest would be like an Aibo, the Sony robot dog, but honestly, those things are kind of annoying. There was just something about Curie that like felt real. And all of the other home robots there are, whether that's something like your Roomba vacuum cleaner, which is just a hockey puck bouncing into the walls, or the other robots that are, you know, their companies are trying to create, they all feel kind of weird. Like their personality and the fact that these things live in your home seems to be very secondary for a lot of other companies, where for Mayfield, I felt like that was their main consideration, and all of the technical challenges and all the other hardware challenges that arose out of the way that they thought about it were because they thought about making something that was truly enjoyable first, rather than like, well, this is what we can do right now.
So I think with all Internet of Things devices, robots included, they have to solve a problem, and especially a problem pretty big, since this was a pretty pricey thing. I don't think that it vacuumed, although why not when it's moving around like that?
Maybe it should have.
What problems was this robot solving?
That's a good point, and I think that's one of the main reasons why it didn't work. There were a lot of things it could do. There were not necessarily a lot of reasons to buy it for those things. For example, it, you know, you could play music from it like an Echo or something like that. and it had cameras in it that could be used to like patrol your house and see if there were people who weren't supposed to be there bopping around. And so those were useful things. Like you could use it, like let's say you had pets at home, you could talk through Curry and be like, "Hey, cat, get off the damn couch," and maybe your cat would listen. So those were like reasons to have it, but you know there are other products that do both of those things for cheaper. But one of the things that was very important to Mayfield was creating this kind of new category of like companionship robots. And as I said in my piece yesterday, like that is going to be a big deal moving forward. And maybe some people won't necessarily want that, but we are a increasingly elderly and lonely population, as is, you know, Japan, a lot of other developed nations. And we're getting to the point where people are spending many years of their lives on their own. And, you know, I don't know if you guys ever saw the movie Robot and Frank. It was kind of like the perfect embodiment of, I think, like what Mayfield, well, minus the like crimes, but like what Mayfield was going for, of like this thing that could kind of keep people engaged and keep you feeling, you know, in the world and not receding into loneliness. I don't know. It was like a really visceral product, but you know, for $700 for something that may or may not exist in a couple of years, that's a big bet.
Well, yeah. And that may or may not exist in a couple of years, I guess, is the big question here. The pre-order customers apparently started to receive their orders of this robot after waiting quite a while, last winter. But it sounds like, did you ever have the chance to truly interact with Curry yourself? It seemed like reporters were kind of kept away from that. And apparently there was good reason for that, probably because it wasn't as accelerated in development as anyone had hoped.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I did a bunch of demos of Curry over the last like year and a half. But none of them were ever, not that I can remember. I think as far as I can remember, every time one of Mayfield's staff was doing the demo.
Right.
Like I could do things like they would let me like pat her head, which turns her on or off. And I could like use the app and things like that. But for the most part, they were in control, which, yeah, obviously was a red flag. And, you know, I said that in my story. But, you know, they did ship. And I never got a chance to, like, I never really heard any backlash or anything from like users, because I don't think they shipped in that great of volume. But I have asked, it was so weird. I mean, literally yesterday or the day before, I emailed them out of the blue. I'm like, "Oh, I haven't thought about Curry in a while." And I'm like, "Hey, you know, we talked about getting a review unit a while ago. Is that ever, you know, going to happen?" And then literally the next day they're like, "Oh, we're shutting down." So that is weird. I'm going to stop asking things I like try one out.
Yeah, we all blame you, Mike. We blame you for this.
So
I take it very personally.
I want to get back to the fact that they were focusing on seniors and an elderly population, because I mean, is that, because when I look at Curry, I think, well, of course, like who's going to buy this? Who needs this? But is that, I mean, do you think that stopping this, they blame Bosch, like the company that bought them, I guess, or that was funding them. That's who they sort of blame in this you know, blog post. But do you think that it is short-sighted? Like, I mean, I've read the books about that we're all a growing, aging population, and we are going to need robots to care for us because apparently we don't care for our own parents. But is it short-sighted for this to go under? Like, is this, do you believe, I know you've studied robots for a long time, do you believe that these personal robots that are companions and can go get you things and such, that is really the future that we're looking at?
I don't know if that was always the intention with Curry specifically. I think a lot of their marketing pushed it as like a kind of family edition, like mm-hmm. for young kids, and the same way you'd bring a pet into the family. But I do absolutely believe that within, hopefully my lifetime, I would assume within my lifetime, based on, you know, the kinds of people I've spoken to actually do this work, that we will see things that can actually perform useful tasks for people with like low mobility, people with, mental issue, recall issues, like you can have robots. In the same way you have like Siri now, be like, "Oh, remind me to take my pills," and actually give me my pills, things like that. That's not going to be too much of a stretch. I can definitely see that happening sooner rather than later. When it comes to forming like actual bonds with robots, that's more of a, you know, person by person basis. Like I personally just have always wanted something like this, and it definitely goes back to like how I thought about like R2-D2 as a kid. And I don't know if that's going to be something that's going to be an easy selling point for a lot of people in the future, but I definitely believe, and I know companies like Toyota and Panasonic are putting a ton of money into building either robots or robot assisted systems for the elderly and for those with like a low mobility and things like that.
Yeah. And Megan, you were talking about Bosch and kind of the post. There's definitely a tone in the post that makes it seem like the Curry team was blindsided by the news that being that Curry didn't actually fit into any of Bosch's business units. So that limited the support, that limited the scalability of the hardware, and ultimately they had to can it. Is there any chance that Curry, you think, might spin this out on its own? I mean, obviously, there was some steam behind this. Maybe it didn't work for Bosch, but the team that was developing this was very, very excited about it. Any chance we might see a Curry 2 that exists outside of the Bosch universe?
I would wonder. I mean, I know that they're both going to be spending the next like month trying to secure investment. And the question will be, you know, kind of as we've spoken about, whether they can find that like unique selling point, that thing that investors will latch onto. And I don't know, it's a tough sell. I do think that their technology did seem to be advanced enough that maybe they'll pivot into something else. I don't know if Curry will survive, but the people at Mayfield, the people I've spoken with, I know that they have a really strong pedigree in robotics. So I wouldn't be surprised, you know, after all, technically the company isn't shutting down right now.
Right.
It's just production of Curry. So I wouldn't be surprised if they manage to keep going with another product, because they really are talented people.
Yeah, and they were able to do a lot, even though it ultimately had to be shut down. They are giving refunds, it sounds like. So even for the people that received the robots, they're getting refunds on their money as well, which is kind of crazy. And also, you know, the fact that there's a limited supply of these Curry robots out there kind of makes those things a collector's item to a certain degree when you're talking about home robots and robotics. That'll be a big deal down the line. But kind of speaking of down the line, in CES 2017, Quartz named the Curry the best robot at CES, which basically means that there were also other robots at CES that weren't quite as awesome, but they existed. So what now holds a place in your heart now that Curry will never tour your home on a daily basis?
So sad. I mean, hopefully maybe I can be one of those people who get the, like the, one of the ones that are out there in the wild. I will definitely put a bid on that on eBay. But yeah, I mean, there really isn't a lot that I look at that I'm impressed by. You know, SoftBank bought the company Aldebaran, which makes the Pepper robot, which kind of looks cool. It kind of looks futuristic. It's got, you know, humanoid features, and it does stuff. It can like fist bump you, and that's cool, I guess. But every one of the demos I've had of that, again, has been very scripted and has been kind of awkward. I don't know if that's really going to be entering our homes anytime soon. I know that some people in Japan have it for a ton of money. Similarly, you know, Sony has made that new generation of the Aibo.
Right.
I personally think it's kind of silly still, and again, really expensive. I've had a long debate with my girlfriend who thinks the Aibo is great, and I think Curry was great. But other than that, like, I haven't seen a lot. Like, at CES this year and last year, robotics was like a big thing. And most of the stuff you see is just like these awkward things that kind of look like humans with like tablets strapped across their chest and like weird plastic bug-eyed bodies that like are scary. And none of them do anything particularly impressive. You know, at least Curry in her non-ability was still like kind of endearing and kind of new, like, oh, I can't actually do anything. I don't have any arms and I don't have a mouth, so I can't talk. But a lot of these other ones are supposed to be useful, and you know, they either have like opposable fingers, and it's like, yeah, but they can't actually hold anything, so what's the point? Or they, like, you know, they rely on these tablets as an interface that ends up feeling like, well, if the tablet crashes, it's like, well, now my expensive robot is broken. So there really isn't much out there that I actually like.
I was going to say my favorite robot is still my Nitto Robotics robot vacuum, because it does something that I don't have to do. And I don't care what it looks like. And I can anthropomorphize her. Her name is Betty. She doesn't have eyes, but she's very good at vacuuming.
Is her last name Davis?
No.
Betty Davis doesn't have eyes?
Her last name is Maroney. She's part of the family.
Okay. All right. Touche. Touche. Well, we can only hope that someday in our lifetimes we'll have a home robot that's half as pure as Curry Robot was. Mike, I hope that someday you'll be able to realize that reality. Mike Murphy from QuartzQZ.com. Where do you want people to find you online?
I'm everywhere on Twitter. MCWM. I'll probably be there in 2 seconds.
All right. Sounds good, Mike. Thank you for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Later. Yeah.
After the break, what kind of legal rights do we have to privacy in the digital age? We ask a law professor to weigh in on #PlainBay. But first, I need to tell you about my belt, because this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Slide Belts, high-quality, comfortable ratchet belts that are easy to adjust. Belts are back, my friends, for the men and for the ladies. And if you're anything like me, you probably need a new one. I'm going to show you mine right now. Here it is.
Where is it?
There's my belt. Yep.
There it is.
I told you I'd show you my belt. Now, I didn't take mine off like Jason did last week. A belt isn't something we like to think about. It's not something that people usually show off on shows like this. But you usually think about it when you hit that last hole on the strap and you have to struggle to make your belt fit. We've all been there. Slide belts don't have holes like your old belt. Instead, they use this patented ratchet design that adjusts precisely to you with 32 adjustment options. It's so much more comfortable than any other belt I've worn. This is such an improvement to the traditional belt because you can easily remove the buckle and then mix and match with other straps for ultimate customization and versatility. Jason's showing off some of the different versatile belts right now. Slide belts offer a wide selection of straps from full grain and top grain leather to high quality canvas and animal friendly vegan. Slide belts can be worn casually around the house or at the office or out on date night or while you're doing podcasts where no one sees your waist unless you show it to them. It's a great travel belt. Slide belts are easy to take off and on when you're going through security. I've already heard from some of you who've tried the slide belts, but I want to hear from you. I want to hear from more of you. If you've tried it, email me at megan@twit.tv if you have one. I want to know what you think, because I want to know what you think about your belts, because I think it's fun to talk about belts. And if you're still not convinced...
She does think it's fun to talk about belts. Talk about them all the time.
Sat next to me for the past 3 years. I do. If you're not convinced, slide belts offer a 1-year warranty, free exchanges, and no hassle returns. No questions asked. If you're ready for a better belt, go to slidebelts.com/twit. Use the code TWIT, that's T-W-I-T, at checkout. And then you can receive 20% off your order. That's slidebelts.com/twit. And do not forget to use TWIT for 20% off your order. And we thank Slide Belts for their support. Earlier this month, a passenger on a flight from New York to Dallas sent a thread of tweets about an overheard conversation of a couple seated near her. The story went viral and started out heartfelt, but ended like so many things end on Twitter these days, as a cautionary tale about privacy in public spaces with the #PlainBay.
PlainBay.
Dr. Sandra Davidson is here. She's a communications law expert at the University of Missouri, an expert in privacy law and the media. Thank you so much for coming on, Dr. Davidson.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
So when you first heard of the #PlainBay story, what were your first thoughts about this?
Well, we are in such a new situation with technology, just rampant, you know, the notion of when do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy keeps shrinking and shrinking as technology keeps leaping forward. So you just have to beware. What can we say?
So what about what expectation do I have? I guess what legal expectation do I have of privacy on an airplane?
The reasonable expectation of privacy is the highest when you're in your home or your office. It's at its lowest when you're out on a public street, someplace like that, where anybody can be walking by and seeing you. When you are in a plane, or let's say you're at your workplace and there are other people around, here's the question. A reasonable expectation of privacy, does it exist? Well, not concerning the people who are around you. They can see you, they can hear you. But the question becomes, what about a reasonable expectation of privacy concerning the rest of the world? And we had an interesting case in California. It ended up ending in 2000, but here was the situation. Some psychics, air quotes, were talking about their psychic network and saying basically it was a bunch of hogwash. They did not know that the person sitting next to them had been hired, but she was actually an ABC reporter. Now, if they'd been a psychic, really, they would have known that they were. Yeah. So here's what happened. One of the psychics, when this broadcast went nationwide, fell off the wagon. He was a recovering alcoholic. He died. But the other one lived to sue and collect. The jury came back with a $1.2 million judgment. The California Supreme Court said, well, we will say that if you do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy concerning the people around you, it may still be a question of whether you have a reasonable expectation of privacy concerning the rest of the world. And it doesn't make any difference if we're talking about broadcast or if we're talking about, you know, a Twitter or any other kind of live streaming. In this case, ABC settled out of court. So this surviving psychic walked away with over $900,000.
Yeah, I mean, the lines are so blurred right now. And I know that, you know, as a generation, we're many, many years into, you know, reality TV being a very influential thing.
Yes.
I don't know I don't watch much TV anymore, so I don't know how strong the pull of reality TV is now. But I know, you know, over the past 10, 15, 20 years, it's been pretty darn strong. Then you've got the potent, you know, platform that is social media, and the idea of network effect, and how something may seem so anonymous in the beginning, and you put it out there because, I don't know, I only have, you know, 40 followers. There's no harm. This is a cool, funny story. But that can, you know, that can completely blow up. Like, somebody in this case was doxxed. And, you know,
yes,
that can happen. That can be kind of a side effect that you didn't see, you didn't think about when you first kind of went down this road. Is there any legal recourse for someone who is, like, on the other side? Like, say the two people, and I realize the guy in this situation went on to go on, like, you know, Good Morning America. He made a
yes,
big public splash of himself, but it was the woman in this situation that wanted to be kept relatively anonymous, and I think she was doxxed. Does she have any legal recourse about the fact that this person tweeted this out and it led to that?
Okay, let's talk about unsocial media. Here's another form of invasion of privacy. We were talking about intrusion into seclusion. Now let's talk about private facts. Let's say that the people on the plane were talking and they got into some very private, embarrassing information, maybe some medical information. Maybe one person is saying, I'm married, but I'm going to dump my spouse who doesn't know it yet, whatever. Under the private facts invasion of privacy, there are two questions that are asked. The first one is actually a two-parter, and that is, would this information be highly offensive to a reasonable person? If you're super sensitive, the courts say, get a thicker skin. And if it's just mildly offensive, again, get over it. But there's also a second question. And that's this: is what is being disseminated newsworthy? That means, is it of legitimate public concern? If it's of legitimate public concern, you can disseminate it even if it would be highly offensive to a reasonable person. But now if you have a couple of private people talking about a private matter that is highly offensive to a reasonable person, then that is not newsworthy, and that's private facts invasion of privacy. Now, if the people sitting on the plane are famous, maybe they're politicians, it might be that what they're saying it would be highly offensive to a reasonable person, but yet it is still of legitimate public concern. And then the law would say, it's all right to disseminate it.
Has the law really caught up with the way we see fame right now? Because I think that what I understand is they found this woman because they knew it was a professional, some sort of professional soccer player who she was talking to.
Yes.
But
yes.
I mean, we, you know, there are constantly, there are live streamers. I mean, there's us, like, you know, there's all kinds of people. You know, what is famous, and has law caught up to what that means? I mean, just because I know that, you know, live streamers, people show up at their house, or, you know, it's much easier for like a man to live stream than it is often for a woman, because it's, you know, a sense of safety because it's so easy to find people. What has law caught up with what it means to be famous?
Well, there has been a problem with that for a long time, and it's developed with libel law, the concept that if you are a public figure, then you would have to prove actual malice, meaning intentional libel to be able to collect. If you're a private individual, if you can say that somebody was negligent, you know, they weren't using a standard of care that a reasonable person would use in similar circumstances, then you're okay. So the stakes are really great. Are you a public figure or are you a private individual? And the Supreme Court started talking in terms of, do you have pervasive fame or notoriety? And the court first started in talking about pervasive fame or notoriety in the community, and then a few years later kind of mucked it up by saying, well, in the community, if it's just like, you know, Palm Beach society, that's not enough. This was in a case involving a splashy divorce for the Firestone Tire heir. The Supreme Court keeps on chipping away at who would be a public figure. For instance, if you are a criminal, and I hope you're not, I hope this is just academic, but you would not be a public figure for purposes of commenting on your crime. What you have to do is thrust yourself into the vortex of a public issue, basically. So what constitutes thrusting? If you decide, for instance, that you're going to campaign on an issue, maybe you're a vegetarian or whatever, and then the court might say you're a public figure for purposes of commenting on the vegetarianism aspect of your life, but not for other aspects of your life. So if somebody said, okay, you purported vegetarian, you have fur coats. Well, I have a lot of fur coats, but they're occupied. Okay, dogs and guinea pigs. Anyway, for the purpose of talking about the issue you've injected yourself into, then you are public. For all other purposes, you're private. But if you are, say, Beyonce, you've arrived. Oprah, you've arrived. You are a public person for all circumstances, so your conversation on a plane would probably be of public interest.
One of the questions that I have around this, and kind of the legal lines that it seems to straddle, is whether it was wrong for this to have been posted at all, or whether it was wrong that once it was posted, it got so much attention. Like, if somebody had posted this and it had gone to 40 people and it had never made the news, would there still be a similar, you know, thread of guilt there, or a similar rule that was being broken in that regard? I don't know. And is there any legal, like, from a legal standpoint, people who retweet or get involved in that, you know, sense, do they, what kind of blame do they share in this?
All right. Let's talk about 40 versus 40 million. What you can be talking about is the degree of damages, which, of course, the jury will be awarding. And then when it comes to republication of the material, it, again, kind of depends on who you are if you're going to have liability. Let's say that you are an internet service provider and somebody is posting this kind of stuff on your service. The Congress has given protection. It's called Section 230 protection under the Communications Decency Act, you're protected. You don't have liability for what third parties are doing. But, of course, you do have liability for what you yourself do. Mm-hmm. So a republication, a retweeting or whatever, yes, you're disseminating it too.
But Twitter itself has no legal responsibility in this.
Well, as long as you are a service provider, no. As long as you're not engaged in sex trafficking, because mm-hmm. Congress made just a recent little amendment to that law.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could keep asking you questions all night, but thank you so much for joining us. And I assume that your dogs are wearing their own fur coats and your guinea pigs are wearing their own fur coats and not vice versa, right?
That's okay. Right. And we have a very segregated household. Okay. The dogs cannot get around the guinea pigs.
Okay.
Yes.
Dr. Sandra Davidson, thank you so much. Where's the best place thank for people you. To follow your work online?
Well, I do a weekly column. So if you would just go to Sandy Davidson and also put Columbia Missourian, that would get my columns.
Okay. We'll put that link in our show notes too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
And finally, I've been fascinated, you've probably heard me talk about it many times on the show, with the idea of algorithms and robots expressing their own unique senses of creativity, be it by creating music or, you know, works of art with everyday materials. Now in its third year, the robot art competition has been a place to showcase just how far computational creativity has come. And it's really impressive. 100 beautiful works of art, all created by robots, seemingly going toe-to-toe with some of modern art's, you know, pinnacle pieces. Joining us is Andrew Conroux, mechanical engineer and the founder of Robot Art. Sorry, welcome to the show.
Glad to be on. Thanks.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So this really caught my attention when I first saw news of this. I love like seeing these works of art and then realizing as human as they seem, you know, they're painted with real, you know, materials that any normal artist might use. This was all done with robots. So first, talk about the robot art competition and how you kind of originally came up with the idea for this, why this needed to exist.
Yeah, I guess we all understand that, you know, art and paint go hand in hand because art is more or less a window to an artist's mind. And I wanted to be able to challenge the idea of whether or not we can use technology to actually replicate kind of the creative processes that artists go through. And more specifically, using real tangible paint, canvas, things that an artist uses by hand, and try to make something beautiful out of that, where a human can respond emotionally to.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you look at these things, and it like I said, it feels like it has a human touch to it. So talk a little bit about the rules, because obviously this is a competition. There's money involved, so you know people have to play by the rules. What are the rules that that those, you know, artists, or I don't know what you'd call them, the humans that are involved here? Are they the engineers that create the artists, or I'm not really quite sure? But what rules do they follow?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, it's a hybrid between the human and the robot and the AI and such, because when you look at it, all artists basically are algorithms. Mm-hmm. You know, they have an idea, they use their experience to basically program what they're going to do with their hands and body when they actually execute something. So that's kind of the key there. But the actual contest, it's about $100,000 a year. We take entrants from all over the world, and their requirement is they have to use some sort of mechanical device, which a mechanical device actually hold a brush, grab some real physical paint, real canvas, and execute an idea from the artist designer himself or herself, or through AI. The key part is it has to be physical, tangible stuff with something as messy as paint. Because, you know, obviously any type of art can be printed in a laser printer, beautiful, you know, you can have a copy of the Mona Lisa on your wall, but if it's actually executed by something physical and tangible and something as messy as what we're seeing here with this beautiful painting, it stands out as something that we thought that only humans can do. And we're starting to get a point within our now our third year of the contest that we're getting much more sophistication when it comes to the layers of paint, the actual technology behind putting paint to canvas.
And so how would you compare like one of these works of art that is was made physically by a mechanical tool controlled by some sort of AI with a print of a Mona Lisa?
Well, again, there's a reason why you go to an art museum and you actually see paintings as opposed to printouts of paintings. I think it's because you get a connection to the artists themselves because you actually see the end result through their hands. There's something that we almost require that it has to have human touch involved, you know, either through music or paint or visual or even cooking, you know, that it has to be done by a human. But it's when it gets down to this type of work, we're actually just making an extension of the human mind by using the arm of the robot instead of a printer. And there's something something tactile that comes when you actually see paint to canvas. As you're seeing here, it's a watercolor that's been a combination of both line drawing as well as layers of color, which give a authenticity that you don't get with a printer.
Absolutely. Those extra materials in there. And now you mentioned this earlier, so I'm trying to kind of wrap my head around it a little bit. The requirement here is not necessarily that AI constructs an image from scratch necessarily, although that can be the case. That can be what some of these robots are doing. But in the cases right. where they're not just like devising this creative, you know, never existed before sort of idea and putting it onto canvas, in the case where they're taking an idea and are they In that case, are they recreating it or replicating an image, but using actual materials in order to do it?
Yeah, for the most part, a lot of the artists, the robots here are reinterpreting an existing piece of art or even a photograph or some sort of input idea.
Got it.
Because it's very early on in this technology, and we're just trying to focus on the technical aspects of things. When it comes to, you know, you give a robot, you have some paint, but actually getting it onto the canvas, there's a lot of algorithms that have to be written in order to get the execution part of it. So that was the first phase of the contest for the first couple of years. Now we're transitioning into a phase where the actual output is important. One of the key parts of the contest is that we're using people on Facebook or just the general public to vote on art that they find is most appealing or it has an emotional impact to them, because it's one of art and is one of these forms where you can tell if they succeeded or not almost instantly. Mm-hmm. When you look at a painting, does it have an emotional impact? If it does, you know that something's happening. And that's kind of the exciting part of the contest as it gets more mature.
No, I mean, there's a lot of AI that creates music and it's, I mean, it's very difficult to listen to. I think there's just something,
yeah, <right. laughs>
there's
sure,
something
yeah.
aesthetically displeasing about knowing that an AI created something and not a human. And we have someone in our chat room, Pushin74, says a printer is a printer, meaning these machines are just a printer. Maybe they're lifting the paint off a little bit to make it look like someone, you know, brushed it on there. But I mean, what do you say to that?
Well, if you look at many artists, even some of the most famous artists, they've gone through school, they went to college, they went to an academy to learn the skills, the craft when it comes to creating art. And at some point, you can say, well, they're just a printer themselves. You know, they have the idea, the creative part, but once the idea is finished, they're working on the execution. So it's a little bit of a fuzzy line to say whether or not the technology is being used or a human through their mind and cognition and through their craft is creating art. So, it's a tough call. I mean, I think the laser printer and just a regular inkjet printer or photo printer, you know, it's wonderful in terms of its accuracy, but it just sets the bar up a little bit higher to actually use real paint and real canvas.
What about a 3D printer?
Well, a 3D printer is kind of an extension to a dot matrix. You're just using 3D voxels instead of pixels. However, we have to step back and say, you know, what is creativity? What is art? And it goes back to the, you know, there's three phases, I say. It's the idea, it's the procedure, the algorithm, the way how you think, and then it's the execution. And it's all holistic. You know, it's anything, you can take a photograph and print it, or you can take a photo from your camera and print it, and you can call it, well, we have art. But the creative process is, you know, how to make the, what to take the photo of, or you know, how to compose it, that is. So when it boils down to it, there's a lot of fuzziness that's going on. And we're trying to see whether or not we can recreate that with technology and software.
Yeah, I feel like right now is such a great time to be doing this, especially with just how far neural networks have come just in the past couple of years. You know, the deep dream stuff from a couple of years ago, and you look at a deep dream interpretation of a photo, and suddenly you see these cats. Like, it's very psychedelic to a certain degree. But it looks like a human with a very twisted mind could have created that, where in fact it was entirely generated through a neural network. So, I mean, take that and then extend it into these physical materials used on a canvas, and robots are going to be creating things. Personally, I feel they're going to be creating things that are equally as compelling as a lot of things that we're used to seeing, because just having that kind of physical material used in combination with something that is truly creative. I mean, it's a neural network creating something that didn't exist before based on its own, you know, pathways in the same way that our brain does. It's just so remarkable that they're able to do this and that they look that good.
Well, we're definitely at the early stages of things. And what you said is completely true, that in the last couple of years, with a lot of deep learning techniques, There's going to be an uncanny valley that we're going to get through.
Yeah.
If you mentioned like the music, where it's, you say, well, they're making progress, but
yeah, it might need a little bit more work on the music front, I'm thinking, with AI.
That's right. When it comes to the graphical art, I think we're getting to a point where the human eye and the way the brain perceives vision, we're getting rewarded very easily. I think we're getting to a point where we might start having a new category of art where it's algorithmic based. Mm-hmm. We'll see where we're going to be in just a number of years. I think we're getting really close to something exciting.
I would agree.
Right. And I mean, your question of like, what is art? What is creativity? I mean, if, you know, you sometimes go to a museum and art makes you feel uncomfortable, like, you know, it's a toilet sitting in the middle of a museum or something, you know, and it makes you, it's like, oh, it's three stripes, like a Rauschenberg or something. And like, that's part of what the art is. It's making you think about, oh, I don't understand it. That makes me feel uncomfortable. And this is like, this was made by a robot and I don't know what that means. And, you know, who am I? What am I, just a printer? You know, so like, if that's what art is.
The existential question of our lifetime. Am I just a printer? Yeah.
Am I, the meaning of life starts kicking in here when you're starting to say if technology can do what I do, you know, it's,
yeah.
But we're all facing that as a society. It's, you know, where's our place? Where's our humanity in an ever evolving world? It's exciting, but it's also a little disconcerting. I think it's future generations are going to be have an easier time because they're grown up with it, but for us transitionalists, we have some changes to go through.
Yeah, we got a little bit of acceptance on our part. One question that I do have, though, around this art in particular, and you know, the art collectors exist. I'm sure there are art collectors that would love to get their hands on some of these things, because who knows, in the grand arc of robots creating art, if we are at the kind of beginning stages, these things could be collector's items. They're every bit as, you know, as much of an art piece as anything else on canvas. Is it possible for someone to pick these up, or did any of the people who created these systems have any intentions of selling these pieces?
You know, we're planning for next year that one of the requirements of the submission of art is actually sending the art to us, as we're going to be exhibiting in next year's Seattle Art Fair.
Cool.
So we're actually going to have, you can walk in, you can see it, you can touch them, you can maybe touch them, but you can definitely see them in firsthand. They will be for sale, because as Andy Warhol says, it's not art until the check clears.
Hey, there we go. And and then I have to wonder, who gets the money? Does the person who created the robot get the money, or does the robot get the money? And if the person who created the robot gets the money, this is just more reason for the robots to rise up.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be happy
about
that.
They're taking jobs. I think it's going to be a while.
We won't have to worry about it anyways. Andrew Conroe, thank you so much for taking time to join us today and talk about robot art. Robotart.org is where people should go to find out more.
Yep. And we're going to be probably around September. We'll be opening up for registration for next year's.
That's
so
fantastic.
Exciting times.
I love what you guys are doing. Thank you and keep it up.
Okay, thanks.
We'll talk to you soon. And finally, Google is working to increase the usage and effectiveness of two-factor security. They're offering their own hardware security keys for sale to the public very soon. I don't think it's on sale yet. The Titan security keys, as they are called, resemble the keys that you've probably seen before offered by companies like Yubico and can be plugged into a device via USB or connect to mobile devices via Bluetooth. And that'll act as a hardware-based second factor for secure sign-in to Google services and products. And I just found this interesting because of the attached news along with this that apparently Google began requiring 85,000, you know, its 85,000 employees to use the physical security keys like these last year. And since then, they say that they report no account takeovers since that requirement was implemented. So when you're talking about security, like that's a large sample set and, you know, zero account takeovers, not bad.
When I worked for Microsoft, which I started doing in 2004, they had 2003. They had the same thing. It was like your ID was, you had to stick it into a card reader, like the, you know, it was like a third party card reader in order. So it was a second thing before your password. I probably signed some NDA at some point saying I would never tell you that, but,
but that was maybe before they were even like a very common thing.
Yeah,
now
was,
you know,
yeah,
everyday people have them on their key rings.
Yeah.
So yeah.
The best thing I have is my Apple Watch as a hardware, because it opens my laptop. And I mean, it's only one factor because I don't also have to enter my password. So, but I have to enter. Actually, it's two-factor because I have to enter my password. If someone took my watch off of my wrist, they would have to then enter the password. And it's not something I can lose. Like, I always wear it, and it's so, and it serves all kinds of other, all kinds of other uses. So I love that, like the wearable. You know, the only thing better was if it would be implanted into my brain.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's coming soon. Coming soon to a brain near you. Apparently, if you are a Google Cloud customer, you can get Google's version of this now. I'm not sure how they're offering that up, but they do say that they're soon going to be offering their keys for sale through the Google Store. And in general, keys like this cost, you know, $20-$25. They're not super duper expensive, but I will definitely be getting one of these to check it out and throw it on my keychain.
But, I mean, would you feel like you needed it in a regular? I mean, I understand that, like, two-factor through SMS or, you know, automated phone calls is not as secure. But, I mean, unless you're a spy, do you really need, like, a thing like that? I mean,
do I really need it? I don't know that I necessarily do. But it might actually be easier for me to just insert a thing instead of have to unlock my phone and look for the code and punch it in. You know what I mean? That might actually be an easier step. I don't know. I want to test it out and see. I've been meaning to do it for a while. And now, of course, you know, because I follow Google so closely, now that Google's doing it, I'm going to see what they have to offer. But you're right. I'm not a spy. Believe me, Megan, I'm not a spy.
I don't believe you.
Okay. That's all I ask is for you to not believe me. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. You can also sit in on the show. We have some fantastic folks here. Bill and Paulette Moore from San Jose, California are sitting in, making us feel special because they emailed tickets at twit.tv. I think they did anyways, and are sitting here. So if you want to do that, join us. We love having you guys in here, and thanks for coming, you guys.
And subscribe to the show. We would love for you to subscribe. Even if you watch live, if you watch on YouTube, just subscribe. And you can do that at twit.tv/TNW. And then you can find all of the ways to subscribe there. And if you want to tweet at me to tell me, show me your favorite robot art, I'm at Megan Maroney.
Oh, I'd love to see that too. Include me. I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to Victor, who's stepping in for the TD duties today. Appreciate your help, man. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Jammer B, Colleen, everyone who helps us every single day here on this show that we do it. And thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.